All right. Hey, yo, and here we go. Welcome to another edition of We Talk Music. I'm proud to welcome the lower duke of charisma. I think that's what
Crown Prince.
No, oh, well, I'm lower duke. Yeah, that's yeah. Better. And the chief defender of the faith.
Yourself.
Yeah, myself. So yeah, we got Mo and Brett.
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm the Crown Prince of charisma, and we can probably come up with loads of other not-so-nice nicknames for me, and you are, of course, like you say, you're Mr. Brett Podcast, the king of the casters, but TA with us today, back for part two, because there's so much left to talk about, is Shy Danny Vaughn.
That's right.
Yeah, and not to mention, there's just a little bit of masochism on your guys' part, but
I'll roll with that. Or was it Lower Earl? Maybe it was. Yeah.
Let's not talk about me anymore. Well, I don't want to talk about me. Hey, Danny, what do you think about me?
Never mind about me. What do you think of my dress?
No, just kidding. Let's move on to an actual topic, because when we last talked to you, we were 1995, and I think that's like. The buzzer.
I think it was
sounding.
1994, but
was it 94?
It's you know, yeah. I mean, what's a year?
It almost seems like we were actually talking in 1994, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
And we're continuing on. Oh, remind me where we were.
The way we were,
right?
Yeah,
right. Remind me where we were.
Left off.
We're just talking about you know, 1994 was a year of transition for you, I guess.
That's right.
It was basically where we had gotten to and didn't get a chance to talk about. It was kind of.
Right.
The transitions in your, you know, in what had happened for you.
Right. Well, 95 was when I officially left Taiketo. And there were a large number of factors. But, I mean, the biggest one was simply that, and I think I said this last time, it was just I couldn't stand the incredible amount of work we were putting in for less and less people, less and less. Not even financial reward, just any reward, you know, just nobody paying attention, nobody wanting to know. And, you know, when it's your personal dream, you don't want to watch it actually die. So I kind of got to this point where I said, you know, it was just incredibly depressing. And so I kind of bowed out gracefully or otherwise, I don't know, but... and I really had no intentions of doing anything musically. I was fairly disgusted with the music business in general. More with the people that are involved and the way things are viewed and the way things are done. And that hasn't changed. It's just that there seems to be more of a chance these days for people to succeed or fail on their own backs. And of course, the parameters of success and failure have greatly changed as well. For 4 or 5 years, I did almost nothing musically. I got a call shortly after leaving Taiketo from a gentleman I had only met shortly before that, Mark Mangold. From Drive, She Said, and several other bands, great, great keyboard player. And he had recorded a full album, which was really almost straight blues. It was more like a Bad Company blues type album. And without going into too many boring details, the record company that they were doing it for at the time, which was Now and Then Records, just wasn't happy with the singer. And I had met Mark working on another project, and he just called me and said, would you be interested in just coming in and putting your voice on this? The songs are written. It's pretty much done. You can play around with the melodies as much as you like, but I mean, it's all pretty much there. And I heard the songs, and I didn't even think twice. I mean, it's still, to this day, one of my favorite records I ever got involved in. And it's called Blues for Days. The band was called Flesh and Blood. And that included Al Petrelli on guitar. And unfortunately, I don't have it in front of me, so I don't have all the names. There was a really, really great drummer and bass player. And Mark and Al had written a lion's share of the songs. And I just got to come in and you know, under Mark's guidance, just blow out these fantastic bluesy numbers, which, of course, I really didn't get to do in Taiketo so much, although you know, some of the stuff we do has a little blues to it. And that was the only musical project I did from 95 to around the year 2000. After that, I just went back to being whatever passes for normal.
Yeah, it's interesting. Al Petrelli is one of my favorite guitarists. So when I saw that you had worked with him, how much did you actually work with him at all, or was it just kind of
times hung out with him, but all his parts had been recorded. So no, I didn't actually get to sit in the room and watch him play, which I would love to have done. I did at his house one time when we were toying with the idea of taking the band and doing some live shows. And we all went down to Al's place on Long Island. And what I realized about Al Petrelli that's fairly unique amongst the sort of known guitar players is that Al can play any style correctly. You know, so he's known for a lot of rock and metal stuff, you know that. But if he picks up a Chet Atkins Gretsch hollow body, he will play it like Chet Atkins. If he picks up a classical guitar, he will play it like classical guitar is meant to be played. He just seems to have endless array of techniques. And I've rarely seen that in a rock guy. Now, of course, you know, now he's musical director for Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and he found himself, you know, a fantastic niche where he can do that and continue on to do all the other projects he likes to do. So, you know, he's done really well for himself. I'm very pleased for him.
And he's very interesting when you get him to sign older works too, because he always he kind of shows them off to everybody.
Obviously, Brett had this experience when we went and saw TSO. Yeah.
So actually that's an interesting question then. Like, is there something specific that you look for in a guitarist to join you? Would it be like Al Petrelli, or is it strong?
I want to find one that doesn't make me want to kill him in the first 10 minutes. That's
good start.
Yeah. You know, it's a thing. Anybody, the guitar players and singers, it's a thing. And I cross over because I play guitar as well. So,
strife must be terrible for you.
I've gotten those guys to behave pretty well inside, but it's both instruments contain a really viable amount of paranoia, and when you put them in the same room together, they don't trust each other very well. It's a sad sort of thing, and I've considered myself kind of an anomaly, and I'm very happy about that. In that, for instance, I have a lot of good friends that are singers, because normally lead singers, we tolerate each other. You know, let's tell the truth here. We do, because there is such a bizarre little arrogance that goes on in there, and it's like if Jeff Scott Soto comes to see me and I'm having a, you know, maybe not my best day and I'm a little hoarse, I really beat myself up about it, which is silly because Jeff, of all people, would understand that, you know, you're going to have an off day. But singers can be really bitchy and paranoid. And so I'm really pleased that, you know, guys like him, Tony Harnell, you know, these are guys I get along with great. I've known Tony for 30 plus years. And again, there's no competition between us, you know, him, Dan Reed, there's no ego involved. When it's a singer and a guitar player in a band and you're trying to share a vision for whatever it is you're attempting to create, it can be difficult because you're not always coming from the same backgrounds and the same musical influences. So, you know, in Taiketo's case, that push and pull helped us make something we think is special. My roots are a little more blues-based, be it Steven Tyler, Mick Jagger, Paul Rodgers sort of thing. And Brooke bypassed a lot of that. Brooke got into guitar with Eddie Van Halen and with George Lynch and, you know, the more technical side of it. We really had to drag him kicking and screaming to sit down and listen to Led Zeppelin for a while. It just, you know, he's just like, nah, that guy, he's so sloppy. And it's like, yes, that's true. There's no question, but you got to give kudos to being the guy who wrote all the riffs, you know, and then, you know, made it work, even though it was a sloppy approach. And that just, sometimes it was just tough, you know, for us to see eye to eye musically.
It sounds like almost like it's less about technique and talent and more about that intangible chemistry then that you're looking for. Maybe for not sure. Just even in a guitarist, maybe in all your bandmates.
Yeah, no, for sure. But, you know, instruments do have at least a generalization of temperaments. You know, like the bass player is usually the quiet guy, usually the level guy, usually the guy who doesn't spend the band meeting shouting at each other, just once in a while pipes up and goes, yeah, that'll work. You know, that's the bass player. The drummer is the timekeeper, the man responsible for meter and time, and therefore is always late to the fucking meeting. Always. I haven't worked with enough keyboard players, but I can say that quite often keyboard players, because they are usually the most musically trained members of the band, can also be really hard work because they approach, you know, well, hard work for people like me who approach music pretty much from the gut. It is invaluable to be working with a guy who's like, I don't know, you're reaching a point where, okay, this song needs to have a bridge here. We need to modulate. And a trained keyboard player will go, well, you can either go to A sharp, B flat, or C. Those are the only three keys you can go to. And, you know, that's something I don't know. It would take me a while to figure that out. And then all of a sudden, he's just narrowed it right down. But I also find that, you know, sometimes, not currently, my keyboard player, Jed Rylands, at the moment, is the nicest possible guy, and we get along famously. But over the years, that can also result in odd battles with keyboard players. I find keyboard players are, the generalization with them is they're usually a little bit precious. They're always the guys wearing the pinky rings. I don't know why that is.
it's the fancy training.
Yeah, could be something like that. So, this sort of goes in line with our timeline now. When I was retired, quote, I didn't stop writing songs. I just wrote with no goal in mind, and I just sat down at a guitar and something would come out. And this was in the real infancy days of having a home studio, which I didn't even really have. And I just, I would come up with ideas, and I got really lucky. I was living in Atlanta, and I met a couple people that were players around, and, you know, this guy had his own studio. I think it was ADATS back then, as everybody was using, which was actually a really good format to work with. And I played him some of my songs, and I said, you know, I'd really like to get these demoed for no particular reason, but just so I can sit and listen to them. And he was really enthusiastic because he had some new gear and he wanted to learn how to use it better. So he said, okay, you know, you use me, I'll use you, kind of thing. Said, great. And he brought in a guitar player, a guy named Ray Sicola that played on most of my demos for songs that ended up on my next solo album. Well, my first solo album, which is called Soldiers and Sailors on Riverside. And this guy, Ray Sicola, it would have been my choice as far as what do you look for in a guitar player? That's the guy. Just a really very, very quietly confident, but never presumptuous or arrogant. And he always seemed to know how to play for the song rather than for himself. And you guitar players out there, pay heed now. This is... You know, if you're going to make a guitar album, go crazy. Do whatever, you know. So, you know, ride a unicycle, play two guitars at once, set your ass on fire, whatever it is that is exciting to you. But if you're going to play guitar for a song, you have to then immediately establish your limitations, because otherwise you end up with what happened a lot in the 80s and 90s, which was you can almost feel the guitar player going, all right, yeah, verse, 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 bridge, 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 blah, 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 blah. Ooh, solo! Boom! You know? You know, and it's just the solo oftentimes had nothing to do with the song, or it just seemed like the only time the guitar player came to life was when, oh, it's my 30 seconds to show you what I got. And they did. I'll give you an example. I mean, you can't fault the man's playing, all right? Taiketo opened for Yngwie Malmsteen once, and one of the most stunning guitar players you'll ever see. You've heard, everybody knows, you know, what a prick he is. Everybody does. We're not hiding anything there. But what I found interesting from a playing perspective was that after 10 minutes of his set, I didn't need to see anymore because he really had thrown every trick he had in all of it at that point. There was no, it was just like the floodgates opened and he didn't stop for air. You know, I mean, what he does is stunning, but after 10 minutes, he's basically just repeating it because he's just given the game away all up front, you know, and that's not necessarily a great thing for guitar players to do. Guitar players should always have some tricks in there. And you turn around and go, what? You know, I've been listening to this guy for 45 minutes and he just did something. Billy Gibbons is a master of that. You know, on the surface, he sounds so simplistic. But any ZZ Top song, I can find you that one moment where Billy goes, all right, guitar players, check this little shit out. You know, and he'll just do a little something that makes you go, what was that? You know?
Billy Gibbons is amazing, no question about it. It's funny because I was just listening to some songs essentially on the radio, and a song with Yngwie came out. It came up, and you could easily tell it was Yngwie because it was just like blazing arpeggios and just this complete, you know, I don't even know, like almost wank fest within song within a song.
You know, I remember actually.
I get that. I mean, I don't know where else there is for him to go now. You know, he is the fastest guitar player anyone's ever heard.
Well, I guess besides Michelangelo Baddio.
Yeah, and you know what? I know Michelangelo, and the funny, he auditioned for Wasted.
Really? Ooh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Paul Chapman was sort of fired, not by us, but by management. And we found ourselves in L.A., so where, you know, great place. This was 1987. And they just, record company said, well, you're in L.A., you're bound to find some guitar players, set up auditions. I wanted to get a guy that I had met very recently in New York who was a big session player for Arif Mardan at Atlantic Studios, and he was just the coolest guy, and I loved the way he played guitar. His name was Reb Beach.
Oh yeah, he's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah. Reb, you know, Reb was just starting to work with Kit at that point. They were putting demos together, so Winger hadn't existed yet. And I met them both, and I just mentioned to Reb, love to get you in, and he gave me, I still have a cassette somewhere of his original demos. It was some of the best, coolest guitar playing I'd ever heard. And Pete Way's reaction was brilliant, actually. He listened to it. He says, well, Dan, he says, it's really, he's really quite good, and I think he's probably too good for us. So Reb didn't get the gig. But Michelangelo came down.
Do you still have that tape?
Somewhere, probably. Oh, if it hasn't dissolved, it's in a box. Yeah,
we're coming to Spain.
Yeah, we got it.
And then Michelangelo came down to the studio and we jammed and we'd seen the videos. He just started doing that double neck heart guitar thing before Steve Vai, might I add. Vai took that from him. And we saw that video and I thought if Pete thought Reb was too good, what's he going to do with this? You know, this kind of bizarre circus act. Mike came down and played some of the coolest rockin' bluesiest guitar. If you're going to audition, that was the audition. I think he ended it by actually just slamming his guitar on the ground, you know, and playing this fantastic riff and like spun it off his neck and just went bang and threw it on the ground. And we were all like, fuck, that was great. He was such a showman and such a good player. But once again, I think Pete felt that he was actually technically a little more than what the band Wasted needs. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know, needs more of a, you know, Chapman was great. Chapman could do all that stuff too, but once again, he didn't pull all the stops out all the time. Sometimes he just got, you know, played some down and dirty rock and bluesy riffs, you know. So, but he, he could shred with the best of them.
Well, it really is all about playing within the song. I mean, but I mean, you know, for lack of a better term, hair metal. I mean, that became so not what it was about. It just became all about, like, almost everybody is a lead player, and the lead guitarist gets to wank, the lead singer gets to howl, and everybody else gets to suffer in that regard.
Well, and, you know, we were all guilty of that. Singers, we were all guilty in the 80s and 90s, thanks to Steve Perry. We all suddenly decided that we had to start songs at the top of our register and go high from there, you know, as opposed to... You know, thank God, and, you know, and that's, and Coverdale came along, you know, suddenly, keep on pushing, baby, and it was like, oh, wait a minute, there's somebody singing in a manly register, thank goodness, you know, again, that's just what popularity will do sometimes, where everybody's just basically trying to sell, you know, so if they think that's what sells, they put on the matching leather outfits, you get your hair all permed up, and, you know, you do all that silly stuff until people get bored of it. Then something else starts selling and everybody goes away.
Well, it's interesting because now Steve Aoki replaced you in Taiketto.
Mm-hmm.
And then he replaced Steve Perry in Journey. So does that make you pretty much Steve Perry then?
No, it doesn't. Not even close.
You're a much better guy from what I know of Steve Perry.
Oh, see, I know nothing about the man. Nothing at all. Just that I think he's probably the smartest out of all of them because he retired on top and he stayed that way. So people can't, the only time they think of Steve Perry, they think of the immaculate Steve Perry. So he never had to technically grow old in front of people, not famously anyway.
Yeah, that's true. There's always just a whole
records, you know, we're left with those phenomenal records. It's only sad because people just can't get over it. You know, I mean, Arnell's been at it for a while now and doing a hell of a job, and I'm sure he still gets, yeah, it's good, but it's not Perry. It's like, you know, people need to just stop that shit.
Maybe, but, you know, I'm telling you that the Filipino following that he has that they brings to the concerts, I think it makes up for it because they sell out, and it's a lot of Filipinos there.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
No, Arnell is, I've seen them several times with him, and he's a hell of a showman, which they needed. You know, and I think he's a really good counterpoint to particularly what Neil does, you know, and I think it was a great choice. You know, they've got someone that does sound enough like Steve to kind of keep it integral and keep it Journey, you know, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
No, not at all. Not at all. Well, I have like, we were in a timeline thing, and I feel like we've kind of gotten past that because I instead have about 4 billion other questions that have been brought up by what you say.
Yeah,
it's a little bit more of a conversation, like you say, anyway. So, I was listening to you talk about how you said you write from the gut or you're feeling it from the gut. I was thinking about how it was like Jimi Hendrix would describe to his band that he wanted it to feel like a certain color. Mm-hmm. You know, like Purple Haze is supposed to feel purple. So I guess kind of, do you kind of understand what he means by that? And does that make sense to you?
Not entirely. But then I don't have the substances available to me that he did.
That's fair.
But actually, well, this now goes, this will cover two questions in one thing, because the jumping ahead now, when Taiketto began to decide we were going to write for a new album with our new guitar player, Chris Green. I've known Chris for years and years and years, and I know he was the guy I always wanted after Brooke had left. I'd always wanted to get Chris Green, but he was doing other things, and I wasn't quite sure if, you know, he is a monster shredder, so I didn't know if, you know, he'd feel like he was having to slow down to come and play with Taiketto. Little did I know, we're one of his favorite bands, and he loved Brooke's playing. And when he was young, we were who he was listening to. But he's one of those guys that I would watch on stage, and occasionally I even jammed with, and he was one of those guys that knew how to hold himself in check until the very right moment for you to go, whoa, what was that? You know, and he had that magic that Neil Sean has, which is he can play a million miles an hour. He can also play two or three notes that'll make your toes curl. And that's kind of what I look for. And when we got him in the band and, you know, he played the old stuff so well, so So we started writing new songs. And the first song I wrote for the new album is a song called Run. And that was one of those came to me all at once, flash of inspiration from the gut kind of tunes. Because I really had a story to tell. It's written about my uncle. And he had just passed. So this all kind of came out in a gush of emotion. So I put together a very basic demo, just a couple of acoustic guitars and my vocals and some harmony vocals. That's usually what I do. I don't tell Michael what to play drums-wise. I let him work around the rhythms of my guitar playing. But Chris Green was an unknown factor. You know, like, what's he going to come back with? Is he going to come back with something that just makes me cringe because he just doesn't get what I'm after, you know? What he came back with from his studio is almost exactly what's on the album currently. It was so good. And I sat here in my living room. I opened up the file. I turned on the computer. And like I said, because it is a very, you know, even though it is a fast-moving rock track, it is an emotional song for me. And I remember looking at my wife and I just got the old tear running down the cheeks. Like, he got it. He absolutely got it. He knew exactly what I wanted and I wouldn't change a note. That's what you look for in a collaborator. And we don't agree on everything 100%, but he absolutely knows how to make a song better without just going out to prove himself to the listener.
I think it's always important to disagree sometimes because that's what, you know, it's that conflict that kind of drives you further. And if everybody were to agree all the time, then, I mean, I don't know. I don't really know what you'd get. I don't think it would be that strong.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, all the stories you hear about how Zeppelin wrote, I mean, they all, for a while at least, kind of just took a backseat to what Jimmy wanted to do because he was so experienced over all of them. But of course, JPJ was pretty damn good in the studio as well. And so they were able to create this real, I don't know, it was a musical stew, what Zeppelin were capable of at their best. Was something that really was like four horses pulling in opposite directions, but that somehow were just able to hold together. You know, it's kind of like you could feel the rivets in the ship kind of loosening, you know, but it that to me was when they were at their best, when that sort of stuff was created and there was a serious push and pull going on.
Well, there was a sense of like team, a sense of camaraderie and a willingness to listen. It's when you stop being willing to listen that's when the band starts to break up.
Yeah, true. True of all relationships, isn't it?
Yeah.
Also, in the 80s and into the 90s, one of the things that happened that I resented was that guitar players kind of took over everybody's job. Guitar players became the rhythm instrument and the lead instrument simultaneously. And what I mean by that is they had the busiest right hands that rock and roll had ever had. I mean, rock and roll, you know, Chuck Berry invented the right hand going da 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 da, you know, so you have a little space there. Once the right hand starts going, where does everybody else go? There's no room for anybody. And to me, only one guitar player really pulled it off and made that work, and that's Nuno Bettencourt, where, you know, there was still room for his rhythm section to be a rhythm section. But most of these other bands, once they started playing like that, you got very, very white rhythm sections, very stale, and I won't name names because it's not fair. And there's certainly lots and lots of bands that sold a lot more records than I did, so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. But you didn't get what Zeppelin was capable of, which was let the drummer and the bass player drive this sucker. You know, that's what they're there for. Thunder is quite good at that. Their guitar player, Luke, he knows how to write songs like that, where, you know, the guitar player does not need to own the entire rhythm area of the song. The drums and bass are quite capable of pushing. And I missed that for a long time in a lot of those technically very talented and gifted bands that came out in the late 80s, early 90s. But I really felt like everybody was boxing themselves into a corner.
Well, and it's tough as well because I think the bands exploded so much that the guitarists, like when you talk about them wanting to become like take over, in a lot of cases they left and took over their own bands and then became lead singers and became lead, you know, the writers. And I mean, they weren't necessarily good at it, but they were given the chance to be everything.
Yeah, well, and that, isn't that Yngwie Malmsteen's ultimate dream?
Yeah, I mean, if
be
he
the
could
only man on stage, you know,
if he could really sing besides Spanish Castle Magic, if whatever you like, I mean,
he's doing it now, apparently.
Oh,
he's now the lead singer. You got to see it, man. Just look up anything recent from him. It is hilarious. Just picture more marshals than could possibly exist in one place. There have to be 50 of them on stage. And, you know, this is a proper big theater stage. If you happen to glance all the way to stage left, if you crane your neck, you'll see the bass player, the drummer, and I'm not kidding you. The bass player is just about sitting on the kick drum. He has no other place to go. Yngwie has taken his band and almost made them play off stage.
That's really awesome in that horrible way.
It absolutely is, and it just makes me wonder, you know, where's Rob Reiner with Spinal Tap Part 2? Please, yeah. Let's go. It's still happening, you know?
I mean, we've all seen, like, how some bands have the second guitarist off stage. Maybe they have the keyboardist off stage. You know, those are the dirty little secrets of hard rock keyboardists, I think. But the idea of, like, you know, pushing the rest of the band off stage, that's getting to the extremes.
Yeah, it is. I like the way Ozzy and Dio did it. They kept the keyboard players on stage, but they put them up in a castle turret.
Yeah, it's one of those Easter eggs now where it's just like, hey, look, find the keyboard player.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, look in the castle, over the dragon. There he is.
Now, I'm interested because I know you guys are releasing your live DVD, and you've come out numerous times and said that you don't like live recording. So what is the hatred of live recordings? I mean, I know sometimes my hatred of live recordings, but what's yours?
You know, it's not a hatred because there are always exceptions. You know, I have several live albums that I love. I don't know. It's just that if I'm sitting in my living room and I'm listening to a live album, it's very rarely going to affect me the way it would if, you know, it's not going to transport me to the concert. A couple of times that's happened. But so to me, you're hearing versions of songs that I love, but they aren't recorded as well. You know, simply because it's a live setting and it's not, you know, studio that took months, maybe years of work, all that sort of thing. But that's just me. I'm just funny that way. You know, people love live albums. And I fought it also because in Taiketo's case, when you're dealing with a band with, you know, a small following and a low budget like ours, it's different. You know, when you get an Aerosmith live album, Aerosmith can afford to record every show of a 150-show tour. And then they pick and choose because shit goes wrong every night. You know, mics break, things fall off, people are too drunk, you know, people fall off stage, people hit bad notes. This goes on and on and on every night. You'll never get a perfect show. It's never going to happen. But if you record 150 shows, you can cherry-pick your best moments, put it all together, and make a live album. That's generally how the big bands do it. Bands at our level, we get one shot. And so I've always avoided that because the other side of that being is that, you know, we're not a big enough band to go out and tour for 3-4 months and get ourselves wound up like a well-oiled machine so that when you get into the next gig and record it, we're just on fire because we've been, you know, playing together for 3 months and we got it down. Taiketo only, you know, will do a 3-5 week tour. So, you know, you have much more of a chance of just not being good enough. And we're always, that's always been a thing with us, being good enough. You know, we never, ever rest on laurels about that. So And there were a couple shows I wish we had recorded. They wanted to, the last Firefest we played in the UK, they really wanted us to record that for a DVD, and we refused. Again, for the reason being is that we were coming into the UK and playing one show, and that was it. And if it sucked or if things went wrong, we were financially obligated to release it regardless. That's not a good position to be in, you know. And you've waited 20 years. Here's your live album. Boy, does it stink, you know. In this case, we had enough time. We had shows before it. You know, there were very few excuses. It wasn't as bulletproof as I would like it to have been. And there were mistakes and there were problems. There were technical issues and all that. But overall, we got what we were after, which is that, at least I think, and our fans think, Taiketto is a very, very exciting band to see live. We're energetic, and we don't allow, or we don't want the audience to sit back and observe. You know, it's what I learned from the great ones that I worked with, you know, from the Iron Maidens. You know, this is a participation sport here. And it's not for our egos. It's to create something bigger than ourselves. But we do it all together, you know. So when people come up to Taiketto afterwards and say, man, you guys were so good tonight, I always say, so were you. Because we're feeding off of you. What you're giving us, we're taking to a next level. And if you're giving it back, it just keeps amping up. You know, because we don't have the benefit of the big budgets. We can't set off rocket fire and drive tanks onto the stage and, you know, have choruses of naked women come out and all. We don't have that. It's just,
you should try and do that last one.
I would love to try and do that. Well, I won't say we used to have, you know, we would occasionally get a couple of naked girls up on stage in the old days. Those were fun. But, you know, in other words, it wasn't the Van Halen, you know, Ringling Brothers rock and roll circus. Only so many bands can afford to do that. And thank God they can, you know, because Van Halen live was a thing to see. But the rest of us spend our times, you know, in the sticky floored, beer soaked, black wall clubs. You got to make do with what we got, and that's us.
It's interesting, you know, you talk about, and as a fan, I know that when I think about some, like when I'll listen to some live albums and there are mistakes on there, I actually appreciate the mistakes. I mean, it's like you're human and you have fun with it, and then that's good. That's better than the live album that's completely, you know, remixed and fixed in the studio.
Yeah.
You know, from my perspective, I appreciate that more, because if you have fun with it, then I know, like, that's the biggest thing for me with a band. I want to see them having fun. Yeah. I don't want to go out there and see, like, these guys earning their keep. And we talked about this last time, you know, it's just that idea of, oh, look, it's a show by rote. No, I want to see you out there seeming like this is a new day where you're doing something else.
And it's just I mean, I'm a big fan of Joe Satriani, and I remember Brett went to see Joe Satriani, and he told me how disappointed he was because essentially he was playing for himself, right? Whereas Leslie West was opening, and he was playing for the crowd. And you know, I mean, Joe Satriani is obviously a brilliant guitarist, but if he's playing for himself instead of the crowd, whereas Leslie West is also brilliant and is engaging the crowd, then it was a better experience to watch Mountain.
Yeah, I came out of there saying, wow, Mountain blew me away. And you know, I could have left after seeing Mountain, skipped Joe Satriani, and I would have been equally as happy as I was.
And I'm a huge fan of his, so when I hear that, it blows me away, but I understand what Brett's saying.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, first of all, you know, let us not sell, you know, in case people listening and don't know who we're talking about, Leslie West, man.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. For sure.
This guy really was one of the first. You got guys like him, Alvin Lee. These guys were the first guitar heroes, and Leslie West just stepped out of the pack with the nastiest, dirtiest, coolest guitar sound ever when Mississippi Queen came out. You know, I mean, nobody had that sound. It was a new thing. And, you know, coupled with that voice, which he, you know, it was just, and the man could play rings around anybody else. Incredible player. Satriani is one of my very favorites. But I understand totally. That's why I think Chickenfoot's such a great thing, because Zach can sit in there and do his thing, and you're being engaged by, you know, you're being engaged by the singer. And Hagar, of course, you know, is untouchable. He's out there doing what he does. So that's a nice combination. Yeah, some guys, I wouldn't say I'd be disappointed seeing Satriani just playing on his own, But I get what you're saying. I think it was 2 years ago on the Monsters of Rock cruise, I finally got to see Steve Vai play solo. Wow. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. We all know how good he is. But again, if I were listening to a live album of Steve Vai, I wouldn't have gotten what I got sitting in that chair, which was watching how the guitar just becomes an extension of his body, how he is just completely enwrapped in this strange psychosexual spiritual relationship he has with music. It's all out there to be seen, you know? And I walked out of there just mind completely blown, you know, that he's that type of musician. I don't think I'd have heard that on just a live recording of him. I don't think it would have come across to me.
No, I think you're right. And, you know, some of it's even just a study of contrast, because, I mean, I think when you see a band, if the, and I know this has happened in, you know, like in early days of hard rock and stuff, where the opener just comes out and just blows you away, and then the headliner comes up, and even if they're really competent and really good, maybe they just don't quite match the energy of the opener. So it's that comparison. On another day, you could watch that headliner and be like, no, that was fantastic. But that one day, it didn't match.
Yeah, I've seen many concerts like that. I mean, anybody that saw the first Van Halen tour opening up for Black Sabbath, absolutely. I mean, Black Sabbath were great. I love Black Sabbath. I loved every song. But they could not match the what was that? You know, Van Halen had like 35 or 40 minutes and they were brand new and in their youthful prime, and nobody knew what hit them. You know, I wasn't even sure I liked them. I didn't know a song. You know, I hadn't heard one song of theirs yet, and it was just like it was being run over by a train. They were fantastic.
It's kind of like the experience that people describe from the Ramones when they first saw them, right? They come out there, they play for 30 minutes, they play 15 songs in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, they just face the stage. It was just being this assault, and then they'd be gone.
Right.
You know, and people just be like, what the hell did I just see?
Mm-hmm.
But it changed the game in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely true. The Ramones were definitely at the front edge of that spear.
Now, I wanted to ask, because I know that on the DVD, you're playing Don't Come Easy, in its entirety. Now, so what's up with this whole, you know, playing a full album in its entirety in concerts? Because it's become such a big deal over the last little bit. And I'm interested, like, you know, what your reason for kind of jumping in, and is it just something that the fans really want now?
Yeah, I think so. As a music fan myself, if I went to see Elton John and he just played the entire Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album, I'd go out of my mind. You know, I mean, I think that is actually an incredibly difficult endeavor, you know, to pick an entire album and just go, right, front to back, we're going to do the whole thing. I don't know when that started. It wasn't too long ago, I guess, because it was certainly not something you did in the early days, except that if you only had one album out, you know, you only that's what you played every song. If you had 40 minutes, it almost covered it. So I like it. Certain bands tour and they just say, oh yeah, we're just going to be doing this whole album. And if it's an album that I desperately love, I want to go see it. I was so sad I didn't get to see Stevie Wonder play Songs in the Key of Life. Because to see that album played live front to back would have emotionally destroyed me, I think.
Yeah, that would have been amazing for sure. So now you don't get across to the United States very much, and I know you're talking about the idea of doing maybe a bigger tour in 2018. Is it?
It would be nice. I mean, I'm talking about it only because I really want it to happen. It's not. It's not like we found a way to do it, but we're going to try something.
So then how hard is it? And like, is this something that you kind of do, or do you leave this up to other people? You know, from your perspective now, I guess as the artist that you are and the stage you're at, how does it come about getting the tours?
Well, in our case, it's really got to be a case of finding another band to work with, to make a package that'll bring out enough people
to warrant doing it, because Taiketto alone isn't going to do it. There are certain areas where we can play, but, you know, we could play Los Angeles, we could play New York, we could play Milwaukee, Chicago, and Dallas. It's a lot of ground in between those places, and that's where all your money goes. And, you know, putting people in hotels and making sure everybody's fed and paying salaries and paying for gas and renting, you know, the wheels that get you to and from, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And before you know it, touring becomes an impossibility. The reason so many bands tour England is because, you know, you can drive 2 hours and be at your next show. That's not so easy in America. Much harder to do.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Never thought about that. Mm-hmm. But actually, that makes me kind of wonder. I mean, were you on the, like, what was the longest tour you did of the United States back in the day?
Gosh, well, I'm trying to think. It was a good stretch when Wasted opened up for Iron Maiden in the States. That was maybe a month. But Taiketto would have done kind of back to back. We would have done 2 or 3 months. I mean, we did, once we finished opening up for Nelson, we went straight on to headlining our own shows in clubs and things like that when we were still, you know, big news. So, you know, 2 or 3 months can be done.
So you were traveling on a tour bus at the time then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what's that like? I mean, what was your tour bus like? And tour buses in general, that kind of experiences on the road. I mean, that's something that I don't think people, you know, talk about a lot. I mean, even the inside of these tour buses, generally there isn't too many pictures. Like, what do people do to pass time? Is it difficult? Is it creative? Is it what is happening?
Well, I think it's different for everybody, but the generalization is that, you know, this is where the drug and alcohol abuse sets in, because there's nothing to do. You get, you know, a group of people, many of them creative, quite a few self-destructive in the first place, and you coop them up in a very small space. I mean, one of the runs we did when we were touring with Maiden, and we went across Canada, the last Canadian show was Vancouver. The next show was Las Vegas. That's a 36-hour drive. And, you know, yeah, I'm not complaining. Tour buses are comfortable, but you get cooped up in anything too long. You know, it's submarine syndrome after a while. I've never found them to be conducive to be creative, to write, or, you know, guys getting a bunch of guitars going in the back lounge and singing Kumbaya. It doesn't really happen, you know. And then the introduction of video games killed it. You know, I mean, I was just as bad as everybody else. But when you think about it, there's no better way than ways to destroy the short amount of time we have on this earth than video games. You know, because, man, I got addicted for a while, and days would pass, and I think, I've done nothing. Nothing. You know, I mean, I was supposed to send my mother an email. Didn't do that. You know, but I did unlock the key to the dungeon of level 12, you know.
Oh, civilization killed me.
Yeah, you got to watch out for that sort of stuff. So, you know, tour bus living, I mean, I don't get on tour buses too much anymore because I just can't afford to operate at that level. So generally it's, you know, guys squished together shoulder to shoulder in travel vans. So you really got to learn how to exist together. Because there's nowhere to run.
I just had this vision of, like, you walking, like, with a guitar strapped to your back along a dusty road, like, hair blowing in the wind and looking all cool. And
what the fuck are you talking about? That never happened. I can tell you that never happened.
I'm sure that's how you travel. That's got to be at least one of my videos.
That's true, yeah.
You get more of that, really, when you do the solo thing. You know, that, again, that everything's changed now. The advent of, like, Airbnb and some of those, like, couch surf and all that sort of stuff. I know artists that have done that, gotten on the internet and said, okay, I'm going to play here, 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 and here. Has anybody got a spare room? You know, and you just show up at a fan's house sure, stay with me. You know, I'll kick the dog out. You can stay, you know, in there. And people do it.
That's part of what Thor did in his documentary.
That's right. We were talking about Thor.
Yep. Oh damn! He never sent him that to.
And he would stay at that.
It's on Netflix. Netflix. Did you?
No, you know what? They don't have it where I am on Netflix. Oh,
son of a.
So that must be one of those Canadian specials.
Well, he's kind of a Canadian icon.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Here you go. You can come. You can come to Canada. You can stay here and watch it. There you go.
You can stay with Brett. I'm not kicking all the boxes. I'm not kicking my dog out for you.
No, well, you got to kick the dog out if my wife comes.
You know what? If your wife is coming, the dog. I've seen pictures of your wedding, and may I say, you did all right for yourself, sir.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hubba hubba. in fact, she can come. You don't have to come at all if you want.
She's actually not a bad singer, so you know.
Really? What does she do?
Huh?
What does she do?
Many things. She does many things.
Perfectly cryptic.
Yeah.
This show has just gotten off on like really weird tangent.
No. All I'm saying is ba 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 boom. That's all I'm saying, you know.
Most importantly, she puts up with me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's the hard part. But at least she's never short for conversation.
Is she Spanish?
No, my wife's English.
So Spain was just kind of now, you know, you talk about a dart throw on the in your newsletter. You talk about like throwing darts to pick up your tour. Was that like for you choosing where to live? Was like Spain the dart throw?
No, the first dart throw for Europe was Ireland, and that's because I just had a couple of friends who knew I wanted to try and relocate to Europe, and they were just, "Oh, come here, it'll be easy. We'll give you a hand getting started." Blah blah blah. So I was, "Oh, great, okay, Ireland. That's where I'll go." And having, you know, distant relations there and everything like that, it was very appealing. When I met Melissa, she was living in Gibraltar. My wife does speak Spanish, and so she'd actually lived in Spain once before. And so when we really started getting serious about one another, she had relocated. She's quite like myself. She's a traveler and had lived a number of places, including Bermuda, and also lived for like about a year and a half on a sailing vessel, you know, going all over the place. So we're both travelers. And so when I met her and realized this was going to get serious, it didn't hurt, you know, because I've lived in Ireland for 4 years. And gorgeous though it is, and I love the people though it is, summer is about 6 hours long. And the rest of it, you know, summer will arrive on Tuesday. You get one of those warnings.
And the rest is rain.
Yeah, it just rained and rained and rained. So
when sheets and
I started courting young Melissa, it was I was coming out here and I started looking around, going, "Wait a minute, this is good too," you know. So yeah, it all came together rather romantically, actually.
Oh, very nice, very nice. Now we mentioned you're in Spain, and we had talked a little bit about this pre-air, but just. Spain's kind of seen its terrorist troubles, and recently. And did you have any thoughts? Anything you wanted to express about that?
Well, I mean, obviously, you hope against hope it doesn't happen. Where we are, we're way down the southern tip of Spain. So the that recent attack was in Barcelona. That's over 1,000 miles from where we live. But where we are is quite a melting pot because it's, first of all, we're on this beach area that's a real European playground. So, you know, there's all the Scandinavians are here, English are here, Irish, German, French, they're all down here, for vacation times, and some own properties here. We're also only 13 or 15 miles over sea separates us from Morocco and the North African coast. So there is, you know, quite a number of Moroccans that live where we are, and they're lovely people as well. But with that will come the danger of, you know, a couple of bad apples in the bunch. And that's what I'm assuming is what's going on, what happened in Barcelona, is you just find enough disgruntled people. I am, however, as we were talking about earlier, I'm finding it really I'm trying to figure out how they're convincing people that it'll be a worthwhile thing to do this thing about running people over with cars, because just looking at it clinically for a minute, it's limited the amount of damage you can do, and then you're over, you're done. You know, it's not like you're going to get away. You're going to get caught. You're going to get on camera. You're either going to get shot or in prison for the rest of your life. How are they talking these people into, well, this is a good idea? You know, I mean, it's awful to say, but I can understand how they draft people into the psychotic idea of blowing themselves up. You know, you get people that have very little to live for, and you promise them that their families will be looked after, and of course that God will shine well upon them, if they do this major damage, you know. But, you know, as awful as these things are, they're happening all over the place with people driving cars into crowds. This is not a maximum damage scenario. So how are they convincing people this is a good idea? Because since you're not blowing yourself up, you, the perpetrator, are walking away from this, which means, like I said, you're getting caught, you're going to prison, or you're getting riddled with bullets by the local police, one of those things. I don't understand how these people are being convinced this is a good exchange. You know, I find it really baffling, and I find it really strange that this is the latest trend. And of course, sadly, that includes America, you know, with, was it Charlottesville?
Yeah.
You know, you just sit there and go, really? This is your idea of something that's going to make your point for you? Because it doesn't. It doesn't do anything except end people's lives, and that makes no point at all.
It's just so divisive, I mean, obviously, but it, you know, because now, like, it just makes other people hate you that much more, as opposed to wanting to understand any side of the story that you could have.
Well, as I understand it, and who knows if I'm right or not, but just the stuff you read, that's the extremist Muslim goal, you know, and with real emphasis on the word extremist here, is to cause this great war. So that we just get so tired that we'll finally say, that's it. You know, basically the military version of what Donald Trump is doing, you know, because the extremists feel that's a war they will absolutely win because God is on their side. You can't beat people that believe that God is on their side. You can't beat people, not with violence. You can't beat them when they're fighting for their homes. You know, like it or not, some of the terrorism America experiences now is a direct result of the fact that we keep bombing these people's countries. You know, I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but I'm convinced that you're not going to make friends by leveling hospitals and all that sort of thing. It's not going to make people think twice about hurting you.
The reaction to violence is always going to be violence.
Yeah.
So it just becomes this you know, on-running, self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, and most wars don't, you know, what? There's no clear-cut winner. You know, yeah, the good guys won in World War II, but let's not forget what it cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just a massively horrible experience that the entire world went through for 5-6 years, depending on which country you are and how involved you were. So, that's a war that we'll all stand up and say, well, that was justified, that war. Okay, fair enough. But that doesn't mean it you know, didn't tear the world apart, because it did.
Well, and so much of it, you know, is written on now, you know, with that almost like, where you put it up on a pedestal, like, oh, you know, World War II was so great because it had to happen and so much stuff. But it's wrong, because, like, those people who fought in World War II didn't want it to happen again.
Yeah, and it's almost celebrated too much,
yeah.
You know?
Well, and you know, the shield beating is very dangerous. You know, it's very dangerous, and I find very insulting for the current president of the United States to start rattling his saber about, you know, what'll happen to North Korea because they will face our fury, blah, 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 blah. Let's take that speech and put it in literal terms. which is they better not do that, because I am prepared to send millions of 18-year-old men and women to their deaths. All right? This is what he's actually saying, but it's couched in all this glorified nationalistic rhetoric, which every country does.
Fire and fury. What a bunch of
fire and fury. Yeah, he obviously hangs out with Yngwie.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and he likes to push people off to the side too.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Everybody over in the corner while we all look at me. And I saw a really excellent letter written by a member of the American military, you know, who was absolutely prepared to do whatever it is his country says he has to go do, but is not happy about the fact that, you know, there's a draft dodger who has no respect for the military in the first place, who is basically, you know, having a big prick-waving contest and is going, look, don't push me because my dick's bigger than yours. And that's not a reason to send young men and women to die. It's not. You know, and the fact that you're facing off with a complete crazy person, it's amazing. We're actually playing a game right now between America and North Korea to decide who's crazier.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. When you're saying crazy person, I was wondering which one you were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't think. Man, if you're standing toe-to-toe and crazy with the guy from North Korea, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah. You know, in the past, and when you kind of get to this, these crazy events in the world, we've seen,
that's the president.
Not me. Yeah, that's the president. Yeah, he's like, guys, stop talking about this.
Yeah, we're not allowed to.
No, in the past, we've kind of gotten to these, we've seen music make a difference. You see songs like Ohio make a difference, you know. It's something that, when you get to these world events, I think music can be really, really important and really make a difference and change things.
One of my favorite things is when a politician uses a song for his own ends, and then the person who wrote that song comes forward and say, you can't use that song. I hate you. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's happened to different people. It happens to Donald a lot, but he's not the only one. But yes, I think music, you know, people need a reason to be galvanized into action, particularly America. It's a huge country and it takes a long time to get the giant awake. You know, we didn't get into World War II for years, but when we did, it turned the tide. I think it was Winston Churchill that said, you can always trust America to do the right thing after they've tried everything else first. don't know if that's completely fair, but I found that quite funny. So music, yeah, as you say, we can at times choose something musical that galvanizes us and puts us into action or makes it feels like it's representing us. But the music doesn't actually do anything. It's the people behind it that use it for something, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know that's true. Now I'm thinking about that. Because I was just like, one of my favorite songs you've done is Healing Hands. I find that an incredibly uplifting song. And it sounds to me, you know, passionately like that's, I mean, when you're singing it, you're approaching it that way. And I find it really just really, like I say, it's very uplifting. It lifts my mood. And I think songs like that can make a difference. And, you know, I mean, but you're right. Unless somebody takes Healing Hands and puts it out there some way and galvanizes people in a movement with it, it's just going to be a song that Mo's going to say, I love that song.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think for me, I feel that it's the biggest honor a songwriter can get is that someone has taken something you've made and applied it to their lives and given it meaning to them. You know, I think a lot of musicians don't listen to their own albums after they've made them, you know, because we know all the months, sometimes years of work that went into it. We can remember, you know, 32 takes of drums and da 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 da. Whereas you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to burden yourself with that. You just get what I wanted you to get, hopefully, which is the emotional result. And you take that free of any burden, and use it to for anything, you know, to give you a good workout in the gym or make you remember a loved one or whatever it is that we do, you know, and to me, that's the best honor you can have.
It's interesting because before the interview, Mo and I were talking about songwriting, and we were talking about the idea of like people like John Hiatt and I thought of Neil Young who really tell stories. And then, you know, we think about it from the idea of like Taiketto in the early days where and other bands where it's
verse, pre-chorus, chorus.
Yeah.
Verse, pre-chorus, chorus, guitar solo, pre-chorus, chorus. That was a
bridge.
That was a common, you know.
But yeah, where the idea is, but you're going out there to do arena rock or something like that. So tell us about the difference maybe in because you've seen both sides now.
In songwriting for storytelling and songwriting for enjoyment, I guess. I don't know how you
put it. There's definitely both in our catalog. I mean, I think we probably talked about this already, but when we set out to write, when Taiketto set out to write our first album, there was a discussion about what kind of album do we want to make? What kind of songs do we want to make? And of course, Bon Jovi had just caught fire at that time. And so this concept of arena rock, you know, it was coming of age at that point. Seeing AC/DC the first year they did For Those About to Rock live, that's an arena rock song. That has one goal, to get, as you know, 18,000 people on their feet with their hands in the air. So that's what we decided we wanted to do, and it's formulaic. It absolutely is. I feel it can certainly still be done with emotion. But yeah, so, you know, part A does slip into slot B, and that's how you construct it, you know, and that's a musical fact that has existed since they started assigning notes to these things, you know. Classical music does it just as well. I think Beethoven would have absolutely loved rock and roll. I think Beethoven was in many ways a precursor to rock and roll, because some of his stuff is so theatrical, and you can almost hear like, oh yeah, he would have liked AC/DC. He would have liked the Cannons part, you know.
yeah, no question.
It's because it is. It's production. It's theater, but it's also meant to be emotive. You can't. It's very, very difficult to get 18,000 people on their feet. Let's say. Well, I don't know, maybe, you know, a really soft Tori Amos song. That's not what that song's designed to do. If you can get an audience of 18,000 quiet enough to listen to it, that's great. That's a great performer, which she is. But I don't think they're going to be jumping up and down going, yeah, you know, that's not the result of her stuff, you know. So that's what we were after. But some songs, like the one I was talking about earlier, "The Run," those just come out, and I'm fascinated on the subject of songwriting anyway, and I read about it all the time, what different writers have to say about it, and there seems to be a certain amount of agreement between writers that their favorite songs or their best songs all felt like they were taking dictation, almost like they didn't write them; they just went, "Oh, there it is." You know, and just pulled the idea out of the ether and it just went. Not all songs go that way. In fact, most don't. Most require a lot of crafting and shaping. I wrote Standing Alone in 15 minutes. And I think Burning Down Inside wasn't a whole lot longer. And those are two of my most long-standing songs. On the other hand, Forever Young took months. Absolute months of drudgery, and at one point we were just gonna throw it out. We were just so sick of working on it, you know. Even though everybody agreed it was gonna be our hit single. We just got so tired of what if you ooh, and what about what if we changed it? Oh my god, you know, and then to me that stifles the process. You know, there's no flow in that.
I don't know, to me, I kind of look at songs and I think talk about the songwriting here, and to me, a song is going to do one of three things, or it could do all three of these things, or two of these three things, but there's three things that really is going to either tell you what somebody's thinking, or tell you what somebody is feeling, or make you feel something, or tell you what they're thinking, or tell you a story, like I say, and you can do all three. Like, storytelling is a different thing sometimes than what somebody maybe is thinking. You know, and that's why, I mean, I had given you a little homework. I don't know if you had a chance.
But I didn't, unfortunately, yeah. No, I wanted to listen to the Hyatt stuff.
I really, yeah, it's too bad, especially here, if you had a chance to listen to it, because it is about, there is no chorus that you would sing along to. You know, and especially in Down Around My Place, like it's only about with his voice and the tone of the music and matching it, making you feel and hear the story that makes you feel a certain thing, and then the guitar gets really heavy,
right?
And the guitar solo fits the song. Brett made a really good point about Neil Young's song.
Well, I find with Rockin' in the Free World, which is one of my absolute favorite songs. The idea that like, I think maybe the music layman could hear the guitar solo and think, like, wow, that's just noise. You know, he's just kind of clanging away at the guitar, and you know, I don't understand it. But to me, you know, it fits the vein of the song so well, because it's like the attitude is so raw and so angry that the guitar solo is brilliant within that context.
Yeah, you know, there's no one way to do it. You know, people can argue all their lives about who's great, who's not great, who sucks. It's all, you know, it's a very unfair, you know, subject in the first place, because it is all subjective. I'll tell you one of my favorite guitar solos in the whole world. I use this example particularly when I used to teach guitar as well. AC/DC, Bad Boy Boogie. It's one note for 24 bars. And it just starts out going, and it just keeps going to the point where he's bending that string so badly that it's going, you're just like, what the fuck is going on? But it's 24 bars of it, and it does not bore me in the slightest, you know? And I just think, yep, you can do that too. And it's just like, I came to Neil Young much later. I was not into what he was doing, because I wanted precision and I wanted nice harmonies and I didn't want abrasiveness, which is what he does, you know, but it's to a purpose. And he can also write stunningly beautiful songs, you know,
like absolutely
Harp Spoon and things like that. But then all of a sudden I changed and I became this huge Tom Waits fan. I love Tom Waits for the fact is I can clear a room with him if I want to. You know, my wife just goes, and particularly women, they just run. I'm like, that's not music. It fucking well is, and it's stunning music. You know, and it's interesting to note that guys like, you wouldn't necessarily suspect, John Bon Jovi is a massive Tom Waits and John Hyatt fan. You know, and we're all sort of trying to get a little of that into what we do without giving up our you know, chances at writing a pop hit. That's hard to do, man, because nothing that came out of Tom Waits would ever sound like a pop hit unless somebody else does it, which, of course, has happened. Oh, you know, it's one of the few artists the Eagles ever covered was Tom Waits.
That's true. And a guy like John Hyatt, you talk about how much he's been covered, right?
Yeah, yeah. Everybody I ever talk to about John Hyatt, they don't know who he is. And then I'll say, you know, the Bonnie Raitt song, or Have a Little Faith in Me, or Riding with the Kings. Oh, yeah, yeah, I know that. I said, well, that's him. You just like it when he sings it, because he does have a voice that tests you, you know?
Yeah, it's a storytelling voice. It's and he knows how to use it well in his way. But, I mean, that's part of it. I mean, we're trying to talk about the song structure. I mean, some of these guys, like a Tom Waits, I mean, they're not writing songs that it's obvious when they're writing it that it's like, well, you could never release that on the radio. And then they do, and, you know, generally won't get played. But, I mean, these guys, it's like they're not writing songs that are, I don't know, I don't know who they're writing it for. Is it for themselves or for people who can particularly appreciate it?
Some of the songs that live with us the most, really the most, really don't follow those structural rules. I went to a concert last night that was held here at a nearby Bullring, and it was three tribute bands. It was a Deep Purple tribute band, a Led Zeppelin tribute band, and a Pink Floyd tribute band. And there were great examples in all three of that, because, I mean, it's great to sit back there and just listen to, if it's done well, you're listening to some of the best music ever made, you know? Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm a sucker for it because it was in a big arena. It was nice. When that double neck guitar comes out, as many times as I have turned Stairway to Heaven off when it comes on the radio, not because I hate it, because I've just heard it, you know?
Oh, yeah. Most overplayed.
But then I watched these guys perform it, and I had chills running up and down my spine, and I just thought, how did this song get so famous? Because it doesn't follow any rules. There's no chorus. There's none. You know, it doesn't follow the rules that we're supposed to follow. Going back to the new Taiketto album, the song The Run, I've written 250 songs in my life. I think it's the first song I've ever written that doesn't have a chorus.
Yeah.
And nobody seems to mind. You know, it's still catchy. It's still people, you know, pick up on it. And so we get trapped in that way of thought, and it's just like, yeah, there is a general rule of thumb, back to, you know, verse, pre-chorus, chorus, you know, there is definitely a general rule of thumb, but you don't have to follow it.
Is there ever an instinct in your mind to try to break out, like, where it's just like, I'm like, where you almost try to force it, where it's just like, I'm not going to write a song with a chorus. I'm going to write a song with six verses in a row and then the chorus, you know, just to mix it up.
I have done that. There is somewhere lurking in my archives, there's an album waiting to be made. I've already got the title. It's called Myths, Legends, and Lies. And it's all my really weird songs that couldn't quite find a home elsewhere. If you listen to my solo stuff, there's always one, at least one song, and even my tried and true fans go, huh? Well, yeah. You know, Soldiers and Sailors in Riverside had a song called Stone Monkey on it, which was almost Chili Peppers funk. You know, just what the hell's going on there? And the lyrics are really odd, but it's still one of my favorite songs I've ever written. So I've got basically an whole album's worth of oddities. That are maybe not purposefully written to be odd, but I didn't stop myself from writing them odd, if you know what I mean. You know, when my little gremlins in my head went, it's been a while and you haven't actually gotten to the chorus, I haven't insisted that I have one. Just go, nah, I'm going to let this song just live the way it chooses to live. Whether or not it's a good song or not, that's more for the listener to decide. But as long as I get it to the point where I feel emotionally satisfied by it. So there's an album waiting to be made, and I'm sniffing around the idea of possibly doing a Pledge Music run and seeing if I get enough money together from friends and family to make an album I want to make that's not really like anything I've done before, much more kind of a storyteller, singer-songwriter. Got some blues in it, got some horns, you know, just some different kinds of stuff. There's even a song in there that's kind of Dylan-esque, you know, with the sort of 9-10 verses of storytelling going on.
I got a $1.45 you can have.
All right.
Canadian.
We will support you on that, yeah, with our Canadian money. So we'll be,
yeah, we'll maybe $1,000 Canadian or a dollar American, I think.
Hold
it is.
Hold that side, I will also accept Bitcoin and
we'll see. Well, you'll have to turn the camera on the Skype here then and see what you can earn. Brett's wondering what the hell's going on right here.
You're going too far again, man.
That's what I do.
Crap.
I don't even remember what I was going to say now, to be honest with you. But no, I mean, I do hope you do that. Though I do want to say, what was it? Myths, Legends, and Lies?
Yeah, that's my working title, yeah.
Yeah, well, that was going to be the name of this podcast, and now you fucked that up, too.
See?
Yeah, that's what I had come up with this morning on my way over.
Way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, just no good. I'll just say, I don't know, because I completely forgot what I was going to talk about. I'm just going to ask, since I was we're over here in Canada, but I was born in Denmark. You ever get by there?
I have. It's been a while, but actually, when I was very young, I lived there for about 6 months.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when I was very young, like 3 years old.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, how about those women? But you were 3 years old.
Yeah, no, I was really not interested in that so much.
All right, Legoland was all that really was on your mind.
Awesome. Well, why don't we get close to wrapping this up? I know you didn't want to go 2 hours. Here we are.
Yeah, no, I've actually got some time restrictions as well. I've got something I got to get on to. So.
Okay, well, let's just quickly talk the Ultimate Eagles. Okay. Because you're getting ready to kick off that tour in the UK.
Yeah, we're starting what's the tour this year? It's the History of the Eagles tour. We're going to play, we're venturing into areas of playing, some of the earlier stuff that's not all of it is household name stuff, like Doolin Dalton and Old 55. We're going to be doing we'll see. It's risky, but I'm glad we're doing it. We're going to be starting kind of in an acoustic semicircle, and because the band is good enough to do this, everybody is a vocalist. We're really going to try and let that shine. We normally open with something like Seven Bridges Road, and we're doing some different stuff with that. So it's going to be a really vocally challenging tour this year. And I leave on Tuesday to start rehearsals for that.
It sounds really, really fun.
Yeah.
You should totally invite Yngwie Malmsteen along. That would really add to it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't know where we'd fit him.
In the back? In the castle.
I would love to see somebody do the same to him. That'd be tremendous.
I'd just like to hand him a combo amp with a 12-inch speaker and say, this is all you're getting. Enjoy.
Well, actually, the big question is, of those, like, of the Marshall stack, like, how much is actually used, or is it, like, any of it? It's just... Well,
for the road's sake, I hope they're empty.
Yeah, that would be pretty rough.
Yeah, I picked those things up, so I couldn't even imagine.
Well, Danny Vaughn, thank you so much for coming on again. We totally appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. So, thank you very much, Danny. You're really terrific. We appreciate it. We're going to give you, as usual, a chance to plug your shit here right at the end. But we also want to know, what song can we throw in this one?
Well, since I've been talking about it so much and it's my favorite, if you would throw The Run On, that would make me happy.
You betcha.
Unless I picked that last time, I don't know.
Nope, last time it was Soldiers and Sailors on Riverside.
Oh, okay, there you go. Well, that one's got a video as well, so people can look that up. Well, plugging. So, yeah, as you guys kindly mentioned, the live DVD, Blu-ray, it's also going to be released on double vinyl, which
is
great, live album. Taiketto Live in Milan, that's coming out October 13th. And I will say that as much as, I ducked the issue for many years of making one, I'm very, very happy with the one we've made. It is not perfect, and I'm happy with that. No vocal notes have been fixed, anything like that. So there's going to be human error in it. But it's also a really, really great, great show. There were 2,000 people there that were really... good to go, and we just to promote it put out one of the songs for everyone to see, which is Wings, and when the audience takes over and sings, that's the sort of show you're looking at, so you can check that out and you'll see what it's going to be like. That's out October 13th, and Taiketto will start touring in October. We're just going to do a couple of shows in the States and then start our European tour, which runs through November to first week of December.
Well, that's fantastic. We wish you the best of luck with all of that. And we absolutely hope you find your way here sometime. Otherwise, we hope we find our way there sometime. But we will definitely talk to you again.
Yeah. And, the funny thing is one of the ways that I'm finding I'm getting to places after all these years of tour buses and bands and what have you is by doing these solo acoustic house concerts. it looks like I'm going to be doing one in the Chicago area. It's private, of course. It's, you know, something that someone has asked if I do and is paying me for. But it's one of the things that gets me to places that I don't often go. So I always put that out there because, you know, it's a concept that really Dan Reed introduced me to. If it's something that people are thinking about, but just think, you know, they don't do that, I'm definitely doing it. So if there are people out there that are interested in that idea of putting together a private kind of show or a house show, just contact me online. You never know.
All right. And of course, you can always just feel free to send your wife over. That's okay, too.
Yeah. Well, she's much more expensive.
Thank you very much, Danny.
Look at that. You got to pay.
Awesome. Actually, so two things. This is off the record. So, number one, I see you're going to be doing a show with the Bullet Boys.
Yeah.
So, please say hello to Mark Torian for us. He was a wonderful guest. He probably doesn't remember anymore, but we really enjoyed having him on.
He'll talk to me. I will. The first time I met him was not a good meeting.
Oh boy! I would say we're off air. And what happened? Because he was such a sweetheart to us.
It was back in the day. Brooke was a huge fan when they came out, and we all were. I thought they were, you know, they were fantastic. And I love the fact that they were covering, you know, like OJs and things like that. I thought,
yeah.
But I would guess there was an awful lot of substance abuse going on because they were just unpleasant people. And, you know, not, you know, when you sort of talk to people and you just know they're just not listening, they're not in the room. So, yeah, it wasn't a memorable meeting. Maybe this one will be better.
Yeah, well, we had heard so much negative stuff about him that when we had him on, it was kind of like
we were trepidatious.
There was some fear going in, and then it's just like, wait, this guy's really sweet.
Yeah, he was a total sweetheart. Sure. Like when we talked to him, and just like, yeah, I mean, that's the only term I could use to describe him is sweetheart. Like he was a sweetheart. So. It was, hopefully you get that guy now.
Well, I'll walk up to him and say, how you doing, sweetheart?
If you do, that'll be tremendous.
And the end of the show. Thank you.
Well, that's fine. Tell me, do the crowd usually sing along with Wings? Is that something?
Certainly in Europe and the UK forever. Ever since we started.
Wow. Really? I didn't know that. I mean, I see, I don't know if you know King's X Goldilocks. That's a song that the crowd just takes over and sings the whole thing for them. And they don't even, you know, they just play. And it's like one of those awesome moments. And yeah, I mean, I would love to see that, really looking forward to see that in the DVD then.
Wings, Forever Young, and Burning Down Inside. Everybody. So, and Lay Your Body Down on this one.
Mm. Really?
Yeah. Cool. Well, I mean, If it's not something you came prepared to do, I usually, you know, give out instructions at the show. So people start, you know, getting into the vibe of it and realizing that, like I said, it's definitely a participation event. And that's how we like it. You know, those are the concerts I feel better after if I attend them, you know. So that's the type of concert I try to give.
Sorry, it's 2,000 people you're in front of, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's what Brett's telling me. Okay, I was trying to ask that, but I'm just wondering, one other quick question. Do you know Michael Hedges? Like, have you ever heard, or are you familiar with him?
I know who he is. No, I don't know him. Yeah.
Well, yeah, he passed away many years ago.
So. Some of his harp guitar playing is just stunning.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I was thinking about, it wasn't the time to bring it up when you were talking about Ingwe, though, and I'm like, well, this is a guy who goes on stage with just, you know, a microphone strapped to his head and his acoustic guitar and makes it sound like an entire band.
Yeah.
The way he plays is just like...
Well, I think of another one who's no longer with us, unfortunately. One of my favorites is a guy named Chris Whitley.
I don't know Chris Whitley.
Oh, really? Ooh, yeah. Recommend that. His first album called Living with the Law was in many ways his least favorite album because he was a very, very tortured soul.
Yeah.
But it is a brilliant record. I adore it. He plays a lot on a National Steel guitar, and it's got, so it's got that. But then when he quit the music business, he started making albums. He was basically a mechanic in his father's garage, and they'd like fix cars for 8 hours, and then he pushed the cars aside and just set up some microphones and play all night. And
wow.
And he ended up committing suicide. Like I say, it was a very tortured soul, but like, talk about stripped down to nothing. What a person can absolutely captivate you. Chris Whitley had it.
Hmm. All right. Well, I see it here. So,
Live With the Law.
We'll give that a listen.
Yeah. That's the produced album. He toured opening up for Tom Petty after that came out.
Oh yeah.
It
strangely enough seemed to be what he didn't want to do. And he got on to some much, much harder to listen to stuff. I think he was also a heroin addict, and you know, like I said, he had a really tough life. But give that album a listen to. That's one of those albums that I can just put on, and it just transports me to other worlds.
Oh wow! Okay, awesome. We're gonna listen for sure.
Now, do you know Mark Ferrari?
I do. Yeah, Mark's a friend, a long time.
Do you have any interesting stories? We're talking to Mark. Mark in early September.
Is there anything you should get? Yeah, you can give us a little bit to get him going. Is there anything you got?
Good. You know, my meetings with Mark have always been pretty, hello, how are you, how's the family kind of thing, you know? He's, you know, he was such a hugely successful businessman with his catalog music industry and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I run into him every decade or so and we chat a little bit. But no, I'm afraid you pick somebody that I have no dirt on whatsoever. Just
we'll just say you say hi then.
Yeah, nice that's
guy. Right. Yeah, tell him I said he's a sweetheart.
well, that's how we'll open it. Hello, sweetheart.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, and then, you know, we'll just refer to you as a sweetheart now too. So.
No, we'll do shy Danny Vaughn.
Shy Danny Vaughn.
Shy Danny Vaughn.
Yes, shy retiring. That's me.
Yeah, thank you very much, guy, fella, sir, Mr. Vaughn. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Danny. We totally appreciate it, and I do hope that that we get a chance to talk again. And I certainly hope that we get a chance to come and see you live.
You know
sometime.
What? Yeah, this time, last time we went through a lot of your stories. This time it was more just discussing things, and it was interesting too.
Yeah, you know? Kind of. I like it free form. You know, once we start getting into what's my favorite color, it's time to go.
Mm, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. All right.
Hi, boys. I'm going to move along. I'm working on a country song now, so I got to get back to the studio.
Okay, right. So you're losing your dog? You're losing your...
Yeah.
car.
There's a hole in your pocket.
I'm revamping a song that I've released before for a country artist. So, fingers crossed.
Oh, cool. Thank you. All right. We'll talk soon then.
All right. Thanks, Tony. Very much.
And okay. Best of luck to you.
Thanks, man. Take care, okay. Guys.
You too. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
There's a man.